Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome to the show, it's the Scott Horton Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. Alright, so yeah, it's the show. Hey, I'm looking at my chat room. ScottHorton.org/chat. I'm really happy I got the chat room embedded right in the website now, man. That's just great. Van Meter says it's almost noon. I guess he's listening from Newfoundland. Or a ship out in the Atlantic Ocean. Or maybe down there in Brazil where Glenn Greenwald lives. Anyway, good afternoon to you then. Happy lunchtime. All right. Marcy Wheeler's going to be on the show. Yay! And also our good friend MJ Rosenberg will be on today, too. So you have to listen. All right, sorry, I had to do a bunch of coughing. And drink a bunch of coffee. God, the Syrian foreign minister is still up there talking at the United Nations. I don't think anyone's listening to him. I'm not. I think he was saying something earlier about foreign countries backing Al-Qaeda terrorists in his country. Yeah, that would be accurate. I'm talking about you and me. Well, sorta, supposedly. The U.S. government. All right. Look, I know I sound better with music in the background. Well, it's the music that sounds good. But I think I'll have to pay an extra 50 cents if I keep that thing running. I don't know. Anyway, so that's the official intro, the start of the show. All right, so I'm Scott Horton. This is the show, The Scott Horton Show. And the website is scotthorton.org. And also, of course, we're streaming at noagendastream.com. And then, you know what? A few other places, too, but I can't keep track of them all. But thanks to everybody else who's rebroadcasting thing. Anomalyradio.com, of course. And then I think I was on Liberty Movement Radio, but then I'm not anymore. I'm not sure. And then there was a lady contacting me about whether I was going to be streaming on the Daily Paul, I think. Which I'm all for that. That is the Daily Peace, Gold, and Liberty. AU for gold, you know. I don't know. Is it the Daily Rand, Paul? I don't think it is. I think it's the Daily Peace, Gold, and Liberty. Anyway, I'd love to be on there. And then, of course, in the afternoons, you knew this, right? 3 to 5 Eastern time. I get replayed every day at the Liberty Express. LibertyExpressRadio.com. They got a great lineup over there, and I'm in it. 3 to 5 Eastern time for the replay every day. In case, you know, something comes up, you got to run some errands, you got to keep some appointments, you have to go bury a body in the yard. Yeah, you just come back and listen to the replay later. All right. So, I guess, you know, if anybody cares, tweet me the answer. Because I don't want to be a spoiler. And I don't want to divert the whole show into talking about some TV show. But I am interested. Well, I want to know. What was Todd about to say to Walt? Hey, Mr. White. And then all of a sudden he stopped talking for some reason. But anyway, if you have an idea what Todd was about to say to Mr. White, I would, to Walt, I would be interested to know what you think. Just tweet me, Scott Horton Show, but whatever. Otherwise, that's all the Breaking Bad we're going to talk about on the show today. I just didn't see where anybody addressed that. What did they think that Todd was about to say? I have my own idea, obviously, but, yeah. Anyway. So just send me a tweet. We don't want to ruin it for everybody. Unless they want it ruined for themselves. You know, for people who haven't seen it yet. Alright, so, man, I got all kinds of news to talk about on the show today. You know, I meant to call Alan, and I didn't. Should I call Alan? You know what, I'm going to write him an email. Why the hell not? I want to see if I can get Alan on and talk about some stats. You know, Alan, he's the guy from Liberty Express. He was interviewing this guy. Somehow he came across this guy. I forgot the story. Maybe he'll tell it on the show today. But somehow he got a hold of this guy that is the former chief, I think, of the Department of the Bureau of Labor Statistics or some crap like that. But apparently this guy is an honest guy, or at least now that he's the former retired type guy. And so what happened was, he taught Alan how to really read the unemployment statistics. And what you really gotta take into account is this, that, and the other thing. Now, I know there's shadowstats.com, and there are others who do their own versions of the unemployment rate, the inflation rate, etc. like that. But, this former chief economist, something or other, from the Bureau of Writing the Reports, taught Alan how to read the reports for the real unemployment rate, the real inflation rate, and the real all kinds of things. And so, well, and Alan, he's a business-minded guy. He's a very nice guy, very good guy, well-educated in Austrian school, business cycle theory, etc., etc., and, as far as I can tell, good on everything. And so, I'm going to see if I can try to interview him about the government shutdown and Obamacare and price inflation and what have you. Now, here's the thing. I don't want to ruin the surprise, but I'm going to go ahead and ruin the surprise. Marcy Wheeler, who is the great empty wheel on the blogosphere there, in the blogosphere, EmptyWheel.net. She's brilliant. You can tell when you read her that, wait a minute, I think I better read that again, because it was real smart and kind of went over my head. Let me, oh, I see what she's getting at there. A very subtle and intriguing point. It'll scratch a dent into your head, scratching your head, reading her brilliant stuff. Well, she's a liberal or a progressive or a Democrat of some kind, like a little D one. She's not a partisan type at all. She's been good on Obama this whole time. I don't think he fooled her for a minute. But she's not like a commie or anything, I don't think. She's not, you know, a real hardcore left radical or whatever. I think she's, not to be rude about it, the good kind of cookie-cutter progressive as far as the things that she's for. You know, not a turn-the-world-upside-down type like myself, and like maybe some of you. But she's not, you know, like, so far to the left that, oh, she's just gonna be so contrary no matter what or whatever, you know, like you might think. She's progressive enough. You could see her, you could guess at her being pro-Obamacare because after all, that's sort of a liberal, centrist compromise nationalization of healthcare kind of a thing, different than it could have been, right? They didn't do the single payer. There's the comp. Yeah. Anyway, she has done great work on just how horrible Obamacare is and will be and how corrupt the whole thing is too. Who wrote it and why? Call it the public choice theory of Obamacare, as described by a progressive. And now Marcy Wheeler, obviously if you're a regular listener to the show and you're familiar with her work, you can tell she's just not one to wear ideological blinders. So even if Barack Obama had been her number one hero up until the day he did what he did with this thing, she still would have seen right through it anyway. And although, like I was saying, he never fooled her for a minute, I don't believe. But anyway, you know, I could get a Tea Party type to get up here and talk about how it's socialism, but it's really not. It's the middle of the road, and the middle of the road leads to socialism, and socialism will be even worse. But what it is it's fascism. At least that's my term for it. I'm not trying to characterize it for her, but it's a middle-of-the-roadist, third-wayist, corporatist, Tony Blairish type of a project. In fact, the third way. It's a Newt Gingrich thing, right? The Heritage Foundation, Newt Gingrich, they were all for this. Mitt Romney introduced it first in Massachusetts. And this is one of the real drawbacks of right-wingers listening to the radio for everything they need to know instead of reading anything. Because they kind of blew their whole wad accusing Barack Obama of being a Black Panther, radical, leftist, commie, Kenyan, Marxist, Muslim, terrorist from Chicago and whatever. Kenya. Chicago, Kenya. Radical atheist Marxist and right-wing radical Muslim at the same time. And accuse him of being a commie when really the problem is he's a Republican. And this is exactly the healthcare law the Republicans would have passed if you'd let them. And that's why it's so horrible. I already told you, you know, Hillary care would be worse. You know, real socialism, which is what we'll end up with eventually, because this will just drive prices so high we'll end up with an outright single-payer thing eventually. That'll be even worse. But I'm just saying, what's the point of listening to a right-winger get it only half right? That the whole thing's bad because what a socialist and what a Kenyan and a anti-colonialist. That's supposed to be a pejorative, right? Newt Gingrich called him that once. And then I've heard, you know, conservative rank and file types use that over and over again. Oh, Barack Obama's such an anti-colonialist. Yeah, well, so what does that make you? A pro-colonialist? Yeah, what a corrupt ideology that is. Get your foreign occupying army the hell out of my yard. You know? What good American ever believed in anything like that? That's certainly something George Washington would disapprove of, right? Well, I guess he was the colonialist. It's not quite the same thing. Anyway. So, a good left-wing attack on corporatist fascist Obamacare coming up on the show today. You'll like it. It's good. Oh, good. And Alan is going to join us. Great. So I better write that down so that I don't forget. And now I better talk fast because I got a break coming up and I got news to cover. So I got fast talking to do. All right. So first of all, yeah, I kind of mentioned that. We're going to talk about, we're going to talk about the healthcare thing with Marcy. We're going to talk about other economic stuff. And I guess the healthcare thing too with Alan a little bit today. Let me mention this. Holy crap, did you see this? And we'll have to talk about this with our good friend MJ when he comes on the air too. But, where is it? Don't tell me I lost it now. Oh, that's all right because, I know, here it is. New York Times. How 5 countries could become 14. What? It's the New York Times. And it's a map of the Middle East. And, you know, they had this thing in the Air Force Times not too long ago, a couple of years back, about how to redraw the map of the entire Middle East all the way up to and including Pakistan, Iran, too. Break off Baluchistan break off Baluchistan from Iran and Pakistan and all these different things. Create a new Pashtunistan and all that. This one doesn't go quite that far, but it does include the breakup of Libya into 3, which, of course, Libya is an artificial state created after World War II, not even after World War I, after World War II. Tripolitania and Syrenia. I don't know how to say it. Cyrenaica? 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 I don't know. Anyway, and then the Fezzan is the desert region there. That was all created by the Brits after World War II. And then, of course, a great part of the Middle East is the map, at least the lines were drawn by the British and French after destroying the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, at the end of World War I. And so here they're saying, well, look, if you wanted to divide it by ethnicity, you would have Alawiteistan on the west coast of Syria. No mention of where the Shiites of southern Lebanon are supposed to live here. Then you would have Syria and Iraq's Sunni provinces combined into Sunnistan, right? Like we were joking, George W. Bush is creating the caliphate that he always pretended existed there, the new Sunnistan between Syria and Iraq. Kurdistan, of course, is a giant region that has never been a state, has never had any sovereignty, but is divided up by Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Iran, and then also up into Armenia and Azerbaijan. Kurds live up there too. And then Shiitestan, of course, where all the Shia Arabs live, the new rulers of Iraq, thanks to the United States, from Baghdad to Basra. And then they divide Arabia up to, again, it's all in the New York Times. This is the Oded Yunan plan. Or you can call it the clean break, or call it, as Eric Marlies points out, this goes back to the very foundations of Zionism 100 years ago, is all of these warring Arab tribes can all just be set against each other. No more nationalism, no socialism, no military dictatorship, no even religious leadership, just tribal. Break the Middle Eastern world, the Near East, really. Break it into 100 pieces if you can. And then that way Israel can be the dominant force. In fact, that way Israel can be greater Israel, growing all the time. All the way to the Euphrates River someday, maybe. As long as there are no states to oppose them, even in Egypt. Remember wondering back in 2002, are the neocons crazy? Remember Laurent Marowick, the former LaRouche turned Richard Perlite, gave a PowerPoint presentation at the Pentagon saying Iraq is the tactical pivot. Saudi Arabia is the strategic pivot. And Egypt is the prize. And remember thinking, what in the hell is he talking about? Saudi Arabia and Egypt? I remember saying this over and over again. General Mubarak there, so-called President Mubarak, he's the most best thing the American and Israeli empire in the Middle East could ever hope to have. Are you kidding me? The most loyal, tortured dictatorship ever. And what in the world could possibly be superior to his military dictatorship? Now again, after the dictatorship has overthrown the democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood and reinstalled itself in power there, what could they possibly prefer to that? And the answer is chaos. Even a very loyal, stable military dictatorship in Egypt ain't good enough for them. And here it is in the New York Times, and this is why we fight, and you know what? I got all these other things to talk about, but when we come back from this break, I'm going to have to talk again about the Shiite Crescent and why it is that America's fighting on the side of their enemies against not their allies, but people who really shouldn't make a lick of difference to us either way. It's the Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org, noagendastream.com. Hey, I'll Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future.
You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. This is the Scott Horton Show. All right. So, yeah, like I was saying there when I was talking about this map in the New York Times about what the Middle East would look like if it was, all the different states, so-called states, were simply divided by at least, kind of supermajority ethnicity and or religious sect, tribal affiliation type of thing. And, they're certainly right that the borders would be a hell of a lot different than they are now. And this was part of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, of course, right? Was that this is how it should be. They should all get their own thing and it'll all be independent and great in the new democratic future of the world. Yeah, right. Well, anyway, the British and the French. You know, the British Empire at the end of World War I expanded by 1 million square miles. That's what the Americans were really fighting for in that war, not whatever House told Wilson to believe. And so there never has been a Kurdistan. Woodrow Wilson had no idea what the hell he was talking about. He didn't get what he wanted. Sure did cause a lot of terrible things to happen, though. But anyway, it's interesting about this, this piece that they pretty much leave Egypt and Jordan out. Is that supposed to be like a message to Egypt and Jordan that we like you guys how you are, but we're going to turn the rest of this upside down? I don't know. And you know what? The truth is that if the empires of the world, most especially and particularly ours, took a hands-off approach and let the people of the Middle East work out their own arrangements as best they can toward independence and sovereignty and whichever voluntary groups that they can come up with or however they fight it out, probably would end up looking a lot like this. That's funny, they leave Oman and part of UAE out too. Anyway. But this is a vile, disgusting conspiracy against them. You know what I mean? If the majority of people over there had a peaceful way to somehow, settle these things with a vote or whatever, they might come up with something like this. This is a conspiracy to make them all weaker. And after all, see, I'm an Enlightenment kind of guy. I think it's ridiculous and stupid, and in fact, if I was religious, I would say it was sinful that everybody has to be divided by their sect and tribe and religious affiliation and whatever the hell. Old grudges, basically, is what all that comes down to. I'm a melting pot guy, I don't know. Does that make me a cultural Marxist? Everybody's an individual. And I think, look, I'm not the expert. I should get Roderick Long on to talk about this or something. But it seems to me like if there wasn't a bunch of power to fight over, then these lines wouldn't matter so much. If the only authority around was just keeping the peace and protecting property rights and things like that, then who cares whether a Sunni imam is the mayor or not? His only job is protecting the rights of everyone equally. I know Roderick Long would oppose the existence of a mayor's office. Me too. But I'm just saying, as we head toward total freedom. The problem here, first of all, is the power. And then what do you expect, especially when bombs are falling? What do you expect except for people to huddle down with, you know, the smallest group that they can. The biggest group they can trust, I guess, is a better way to put it. You know? Like when America's attacking Iraq, does it make sense for people to, well, invading and occupying Iraq, does it make sense for people to vote for the people who seem like the most enlightened, melting pot kind of let's all get along in a new democracy kind of thing? Or does it make more sense to vote for the people who are from your slate, that represent your neighborhood, that swear that they're going to protect you from those other guys in the midst of an American-created civil war? Well, look, the proof's in the pudding. You know, they voted for the United Iraqi Alliance on the Shiite side and Islamic State on the Sunni side. And the civil war continues to rage. Even John Stewart. I remember even John Stewart going, wow, purple fingers on their thumbs. Yeah, but who won? What happened? The majority won the war. The minority boycotted the thing and lost everything. And you think, what? Because the people who won got some photo ops with some purple on their fingers that now everything's going to be fine? That the losers are just going to respect that they lost and give in on everything? That was the start of the freaking war, was the election of 05. Well, the writing of the Constitution of 04. Anyway, and I know that there are people who say that this is really what they wanted all along, that the entire neoconservative project has been to simply, you know, like I was just quoting that Mirowet guy, to destroy Arabia and everything else. But I think, well, I don't know. It has turned out that way. In fact, William S. Lind has a thing at the American Conservatives saying that it's an accidental side effect of Bush's most horrible blunder that anyone could have ever imagined, which was invading Iraq and basically fighting the civil war for the Shiite Arab groups to take all of Baghdad. That this is the first time since 1117, I think it was, 11-something, that the Shiites have controlled an Arab capital. The last time it was Cairo. 1,000 years ago. And so this has completely shaken up the entire Middle East and reawakened a region-wide Sunni-Shia civil war, with Iran backing the Shia Arabs and Saudi Arabia backing the Sunnis. And, of course, the way William S. Lind is saying it is go ahead and let them fight it out and leave them alone, which is, I guess, the second best option to, well, whatever, I guess I would take it. I don't see why there's any reason that they have to keep fighting. I think if we would back off, these things would certainly settle themselves much faster. But, of course, I was going to say, was it an accident? I think it was an accident. Wolfowitz didn't want this. Wolfowitz thought he was smart. Wolfowitz thought that Iraq was going to be a model democracy, American Arab ally, and was going to set the tone for the rest of the region to try to follow suit, and they were all going to elect pro-American people. I mean, I've talked with people who actually know him who swore that, no, he really believed that. But then again, that could have all just been a front for doing what Ariel Sharon wanted, which was killing everything and smashing everyone. Why not? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now,
You know, they publish great articles at FFF.org every day, but their best stuff goes in the Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for the Future of Freedom at FFF.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's the show. The Scott Horton Show. Here on No Agenda. First up today is Marcy Wheeler. Empty Wheel, they call her on the internet. EmptyWheel.net. She's at Empty Wheel, of course, on Twitter, too. Hi, Marcy. How the hell are you?
I'm good. Yourself?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today.
Sure.
You got a great blog. Man, you keep... I don't know how many hours a day you work on this thing, and I know you've got a couple of partners there helping you out, but boy, oh boy, do you cover everything, and in such depth. It's just incredible. I could just forget everything else and just read your blog. You keep me up to date on it all, it looks like here.
On those very narrow subjects we actually cover.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, foreign policy and civil liberties. If that's very narrow, then yeah, I guess you're you're very narrow on just covering everything that I'm interested in. All right, well, anyway, enough praising you. So first of all, let's talk about this little bitty, no big deal story that came out in the New York Times by James Risen, and their number one national security guy, and Laura Poitras, recipient of the original Snowden document leak there with Glenn Greenwald. They published this thing that I think basically proved that the NSA's been telling the truth about everything this whole time, right?
You mean Bill Binney, the NSA whistleblower, has been telling the truth about this.
Oh, right, right. That's what I meant.
Right. Bill Binney used to be one of the top people at NSA, and after 9/11, he quit because we were doing so much spying on Americans. And especially last year, he started saying that NSA has dossiers of Americans. And Keith Alexander, as he does, went out and said, oh, gosh, we don't have any dossiers. And that story, the dossiers, Bill Binney's claim that that the NSA was putting together these dossiers, was actually one of the rebuttal attempts that led to James Clapper lying to Congress, lots of back and forth between Ron Wyden and Keith Alexander and James Clapper. But basically what the New York Times reported is that in addition to basically the NSA is trying to figure out who in the United States talks to its foreign intelligence targets. And by this, it's not just terrorists. So it's no longer if you don't talk to a terrorist in Yemen, you're safe. It's also things like do you talk to foreign diplomats? Do you talk to people who might be proliferators? I mean, basically, this covers all of their foreign intelligence collection targets, emphasis. And so if you talk to interesting people overseas, what they're going to do is they're going to put together a portfolio on you that includes not just who you contact, who your friends are, whether by internet or phone. And one of the things this story revealed is they're collecting this phone metadata and location via some other means that's not the business records FISA that we keep talking about. But they're also getting your Facebook information and banking information and travel information and yada, yada. So they're collecting a broad breadth of information to figure out who it is that has interesting ties with their foreign intelligence targets.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a big part of the story, I guess, too, is how well they use this information, how they perfected how to put it all together. It's sort of... It makes the kind of proverbial FBI file pale, right? They just hit enter, and all of their different computers and databases and data mining machines and records of everything all assemble themselves on the screen in an instant. They don't need to have the complete file. It just it comes from its bits and pieces, and then they can analyze everything about. I don't have it right in front of me, but I think they use the term graph. Like, they can represent visually everyone's connections to everyone and everything important about them, even who has ridden in a car with them down the highway before and all of these kinds of things, right?
Right. This is total information awareness, but done not, again, not just for counterterrorism, but for all of NSA's intelligence collection programs.
So, I think, you know, remember the Simpsons movie where they have 100 million NSA guys sitting there spying on everyone? And that, and then the joke is that obviously it doesn't work like that. They're not spying on us all. South Park was like that, too, where, oh, we're spying on this guy making arrangements to pick up dinner and the kid from soccer practice and whatever. But they are. It's just, it doesn't take that much manpower to do it. It's the computer.
Right. I mean, and they, you know, and they've got so many different data collection places, that they, you know, it just, they get, it's just, it's automated. One of the lines in that story, which I thought was apt, was this is the digital equivalent of tailing somebody, of following somebody in real life and figuring out what they're doing. Although, you know, it's every time we've been told that metadata is that much more revealing, what this shows is that they're developing the metadata with focus on American citizens, and they're bringing together all of these multiple sources of metadata. So it's not just our phone records. They're, you know, they're tying the metadata in with our, they're tying the phone metadata in with our Facebook and with everything else and with our phone records. So it's just this incredible rich picture.
Now, I guess this sounds silly and I don't even know if I have a point, but I've been meaning to mention this all along, which is that Dean Koontz, who I guess people consider him the knockoff Stephen King writer. Well, when I was in high school or just out of high school, maybe, I read a book by him called Dark Rivers of the Heart, where the antagonist is a agent who works for a government agency with no real title. I think he gets his paycheck through the Department of Justice and he works for the Deputy Attorney General, but really he's just a secret hitman for the deep state kind of thing. And he just opens up his laptop and types in the right code, and he has access to every computer in the world, basically. It's the mama computer. And by way of the National Security Agency, it's hacked into every other government database and every major private database. And it's basically this kind of total information awareness, just, you know. And I don't know how far into it they really were, so this would have been like, I don't know, 95 or 96 or something like that, I guess, when I read this. I don't know, you know, how sophisticated it was then, but certainly the premise was there that, you know, after all, that's why the government funded all this high-tech revolution over the last few generations in the first place, right? Is to keep tabs of everybody, the Russians and the Americans too.
Right. Right, right.
I mean, the Ma Bell, AT&T was just a project of the NSA, if you want to look at it that way. I mean, they built the entire telecommunications infrastructure of the United States and of the world from the bottom up. So, you know, of course they're tapping the backbone. It's their backbone, you know?
Yeah, right. Right.
But anyway, so the problem is this. There's the old law that says that, hey, you can't investigate me unless you got a predicate, right? Whatever happened to that? And that's really what we're talking about here, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the interesting things is, also released yesterday, David Crist, who used to be in charge of National Security Division in DOJ and is one of the smarter people on this, he just released an article on the business records FOIA, not on this. But, you know, he provided the explanation of relevance that the government has been unable to provide. I think they're going to all start stealing from David Chris's article. But it was interesting because he was sort of like, you know, these are enterprise investigations. This is what we're supposed to be doing. And the government has basically include, you know, once you've got that relevance language going on, which they do, then you've got this notion that they can do an enterprise investigation, which is, you know, we're just going to go out and try and find the terrorists. But they can include us as targets in that enterprise investigation because of this kind of crazy haystack theory that they have. And then they reapplied it to foreign intelligence. So, you know, that's how things get out of control. But that appears to be what has happened.
Well, so it's confusing to me about that. Any connection to anything foreign leads to any American, basically, right? I mean, how many degrees of separation are we talking about? Or how many Americans are they, do they say in here what percentage of us this accounts for? I mean, obviously some people don't ever talk to anyone overseas, even by a couple of degrees of separation, but pretty much everybody's got a couple of hops, as they call it, right? This haystack theory that everybody could be caught up in this, basically, right?
Well, they could be. We don't know. And I suspect that, remember that Ron Wyden keeps asking for the number of Americans who have been searched on, because they're the NSA and one other agency, probably FBI, have the authority to take what's called incidentally collected information and search on it for U.S. person data. And so I suspect that's part of where this data comes from. In other words, they've explained to themselves that they can collect that they can collect on targets. So, you know, that Yemeni terrorist. I'm going to sneeze in a second. Hold on. May have gone away. But they also, you know, along with targeting that terrorist, then they get a couple hops away from the terrorist, and that's when they get into, you know, journalists or human rights workers or what have you in the United States. But then they can go in and, having collected that information on human rights workers in the United States, go in and collect and use it, right? And so I suspect that's part of what's going on, but in spite of Ron Wyden's repeated efforts, the government claims we can't tell you the number of Americans who are being searched on in that fashion, because if we did, it would be a privacy violation, among other things.
Yeah.
And also, we don't have the resources to count how many Americans we're spying on in this fashion. That's the answer.
Oh, they can't. They would like to tell you, but they don't have the answer. And if they did have the answer, then it would be a violation of your privacy to notify you that you've been spied on. Not even that. It would be a violation of one's privacy, a mythical one, if they reveal the total number of Americans that they had spied on? And that just sounds like a non sequitur, really.
It's an excuse. I mean, you know, when you get an answer like that from the government, a safe bet is that if they actually told us how many Americans they were spying on, then we'd be outraged and we'd make sure it was changed. So they're not going to, you know. And the other thing about that is, if they can't pull up the number automatically, it means they can't audit it very easily, because they can't, you know, they're not keeping well enough track of, you know, when people are actually spying on Americans to just pull up a number, right? So it just doesn't, you know, the fact that they refuse to answer that question should be setting up alarm bells everywhere,
yeah,
especially given this New York Times disclosure, this new story.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I mean, it kind of sounds silly, because I know nobody pays much attention to me. It's not like I'm breaking major news stories here or anything like that. But I do recognize that, you know, my own personal tale of chilling effect here, that, you know, I talk to people who are former CIA officers. I talk to people who are real journalists who do have sources overseas that, you know, may very well be the focus of whatever type investigation. Right? This is like part of Chris Hedges' lawsuit was, hey, I'm a reporter. I talk to Al-Qaeda sometimes. But, geez, so what does that mean for me? Well, I got Chris Hedges' number in my cell phone, probably still. It's been a while. But so then, does that mean that they're keeping tabs of everybody I ever ride in a car with, and by a hop or two, I got, you know, skater buddies of mine are now linked to Al-Qaeda in the mind of the computers of the government of my country, you know?
Right.
It makes me feel like, well, maybe I just shouldn't be palling around either with my friends, who are my true friends, or maybe I shouldn't be palling around with these journalists who are doing good work. Maybe I'm, you know, responsible for getting somebody in trouble, and I should stop doing something that I'm doing, even though I'm not doing anything wrong. And even though, as I said in the first place, I'm not trying to be extra paranoid. I know that I'm not all that consequential or anything, but I'm just saying it occurs to me, you know?
Right, right. And, you know, and they can use this stuff for espionage investigations, and you and I both have Glenn Greenwald's contact in our cell phone, right?
No doubt about
it. You're telling
me
that, yeah. So it's just, you know, what it demands is more disclosures, and this is probably some of the stuff the NSA has been trying to hide most diligently from us. And can I just, interject and say that I love the notion that James Risen and Laura Poitras are working on the story together, because that's got to make the NSA pee its collective pants just by seeing their byline together.
Oh, yeah, because, in fact, the article even starts out, that was how I captioned it when I posted on Facebook, too. Cool byline, Risen and Poitras. I really like that. And then I think it's paragraph two that says, according to documents provided by Edward Snowden and interviews with senior officials. Yeah, that's that James Risen connection there, where he goes, oh, okay, so here's a bunch of information. For context, let's go to the very best sources that any journalists have in America on the national security beat.
Yep.
Sweet. Very good. And it also is, that represents the most severe investment on behalf of the most important newspaper in America, too. I mean, Bart Gellman from the Washington Post, I love that guy, and it's important that he was in on it from the beginning. I think Edward Snowden made a very good choice in bringing him in on it. But now what are they going to do about it when James Risen is on the story? In fact, I thought it was kind of strange, Marcy. What did you think about when it started off? It was just Scott Shane, and it seemed as though like Risen was being excluded, or I don't know. Was there something to that, or are we wasting time when we should be on more important things?
You know, I did a post on that. I thought it was sort of interesting that Shane was included, just because Shane's become, you know, I blame the prosecutions of journalist sources as much as anything else, but Shane has become very much a way the administration gets out its official version of the story of late. And given what the New York Times did with the WikiLeaks cables, where they, you know, went out of their way to basically tell the government what they had, mm-hmm. sort of spying on themselves, the government, I just thought it was dubious. But, hey, I'm really happy to see Risen working with Poitras. Sounds great.
Well, and I really want to see Charlie Savage on it, too, because, you know, he's a very independent-minded and kind of a journalist. And also, you know, he's like you. He's really smart on this stuff. It all makes a lot of sense to him when he looks at it, where the rest of us are kind of scratching our head and waiting for Marcy to explain it kind of a thing. So, you know, I'd very much like to see him on the case. But anyway, plenty of time and apparently plenty of documents still to come.
Exactly, yeah.
So, so that's really good. All right, now, so let me ask you about Obamacare, because you did a lot of work on this, and frankly, I probably agree with, well, I wouldn't say the right-wing critique, but, you know, I got a libertarian critique of the whole thing, but I'm very interested in Greg Palast wrote Obamacare is 98% Cheney, and of course, Greg Palast being, you know, total pro-democracy, pro-regulatory state, good government, kind of a public utilities, sort of a progressive kind of a guy. And he says, this is 98% Cheney. And I'm really more interested in a left-wing critique like that, or a liberal or progressive critique like that, than, you know, Obama's from Kenya and he's here to turn us all over to Vladimir Lenin or Putin or whoever. So I was wondering if you could tell us about some of the work that you did on the healthcare law and its origins and some of the likely consequences from your point of view.
Sure. I mean, I'll say up front, there are parts of it that are unquestionably good. And those are the expansion of Medicaid with, and I'll put in a caveat in just a second, because until we get the poorest Americans actually receiving health care rather than emergency room care, the rest of us are going to be subsidizing them anyway. So better subsidize them in primary care than subsidize them in our hospital bills. So that's one thing that's good. The other thing that's good is through Medicare, the government is trying to deliver services better. And they've been able to do this in the VA. I mean, the VA actually has far better outcomes than even Medicare and certainly our private services. And so, you know, the goal is to deliver health care better and more effectively without taking away our fake knees and stuff like that. So those are both unquestionably good aspects of Obamacare. But there are, you know, and I'll go back to the Medicaid. One complaint I had from the very beginning, and I was screaming about it at the time, was that if you're a corporation, the only way to get health care for your employees provided for free is to ensure that they are poor, that they stay under that 122% of poverty level, that means that they can get Medicaid for free, because the Medicaid's always going to be better than what they would provide, and they qualify. And we knew, I mean, Walmart was at the table when they were designing Obamacare. And we knew even then that Walmart relied on Medicaid in those states, and California is one of them, in those states where the qualification level was high enough such that people who worked could actually get Medicaid as well. So we had to expect that you know, this was one of the primary things that Walmart was interested in doing. So what's happened since? Walmart has moved a bunch of people to part-time, ensuring that they're not, that they don't qualify for Walmart's own healthcare system, and also ensuring that they're too poor, that they're poor enough that they're going to qualify for the Medicaid in the states where it's been expanded. And so basically what we've done is given huge employers an incentive to pay their people poverty wages. And we've seen that roll out. And, you know, it's not a surprise.
And you're saying that's what Walmart was doing at the table, was making sure that it was that way. This is an accidental, unforeseen consequence.
It can't be unforeseen, because it made perfect sense to me at the time, and it's perfectly it matches Walmart's past behavior perfectly, because we knew they already were relying on Medicaid, and it matches what they've done since. So, you know, it seems to me it was part of the plan, and I was screaming about it at the time, and people are like, oh, you don't really have to worry about it, and I said, I'm worried about it.
Or they'll say, even Walmart thinks it's a good idea. You know, even my enemy agrees with me, so I must be right, kind of a confirmation bias error, you know?
Right.
The same thing that happens with the minimum wage, of course. They always push for an increase in the minimum wage. Well, they already pay a little bit more than the minimum wage anyway, so it doesn't really affect them, but it does help bankrupt all the mom and pops, the last ones in town still competing with them, who can no longer afford to hire high school kids as summer jobs anymore, and that kind of thing. And, you know, it's always an ulterior motive, no matter how good they're trying to make it sound. And, of course, maybe it's just my confirmation bias only. Seems like I'm right all the time, that when they're in on it, that, yeah, you're right to be suspicious of them and their motives, and to take it as confirmation that something underhanded is going on here. Didn't you write about how, like, the number one insurance company lobbyist in America lady was the primary author of the whole thing?
Right. If you looked at the bill as it came out of Max Baucus's office, it actually had this Fowler is her last name. I'm trying to remember. I think Liz Fowler. The woman whose name was on the PDF file was this woman who had been vice president of, and I forget which insurance company it was, but of one of the biggest insurance companies in the country.
See, this is why I love Marcy Wheeler. She went and clicked properties, right-clicked properties on the PDF file, and went and saw the original author, and there she was, right?
That one actually was one of my readers, but my readers are brilliant, okay. So...
You guys are great.
But yeah, that's important to note that, like, and then she has since gone back to the private sector. So, you know, it's this case of revolving door. It happened at a time when the insurance companies, because of the economic crash, were in a bunch of trouble because, you know, the financial crash, because they're basically, the insurance is just a way to get money to go play on the stock market. It's not entirely true, but I'll just leave it at there. And so so what it did was give insurance companies a huge new batch of subsidized consumers while doing not enough. I mean, there are means, you know, one of the other really good things about the bill, about the law, is something called medical loss ratio, which limits how much the insurance companies can charge for overhead and executive salaries and so on. And, you know, it was implemented imperfectly. It was implemented with the rates set way too low. So, in other words, rather than 90% has to go to healthcare, depending on where you are and how much you're getting subsidized, 75 or 80% has to go to healthcare. But that has already led to people getting money back. You know, so if the insurance company is spending too much on stuff that's not healthcare, then you get money back because you paid. So it is good. It could be a lot better, but that is good. But nevertheless, you know, there were those kinds of limits. But with the exception of those limits, basically what it did was give insurance companies a captive set of consumers without doing enough to kind of reel in the ugliness that is insurance companies. And, you know, we're already seeing them find ways to get around the new rules placed on them. So just as an example, I'm a cancer survivor. And before Obamacare got passed, I have great insurance. My insurance company always paid for all my mammograms. Obamacare passed a must cover preventative care, which was sold as this will cover mammograms. But for people like me who have to get really high-level mammograms because I'm a cancer survivor, the first time it went through, the insurance company said, oh, this is not preventative care, it's diagnostic care, and charged me for it for the first time. And charged me, and because I'm, you know, a cancer survivor, I have to get the digital mammograms and yada, yada, yada. And so, you know, the insurance companies still suck. And this Obamacare didn't change the fundamental problem. You know, insurance companies are primarily regulated at the state level. Those state commissioners tend to be well-funded insurance company lovers. So in very few states is there really effective regulation of insurance companies. And so you're going to see stuff like this. You're going to see insurance companies find ways to game the system. And until you use at the federal level real sticks to stop that from happening, we're still stuck with really crummy insurance companies.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing sounds to me like the ultimate in regulatory capture. And
absolutely,
And I wanted to say real quick, too, because I meant to say before, but I forgot, but it's an important point to bring up, which is that there are a lot of companies slashing hours, like you were talking about with Walmart there, but it's not because they want to, because they're evil like Walmart and whatever. It's because they have no choice, and it's going on all over the place. I see on my Facebook feed, the local YMCA cut everybody's hours down to 35, and whatever it is, all over the place. And a lot of these bosses hate this. These are their people, you know? They're human beings with personal relationships here. It's not just as easy as, oh yeah, sorry guys, cutting your hours, but they have to follow suit because what else are they going to do? So there's, you know, the unforeseen consequences, like you're saying, of course, the insurance companies are going to continue to find every way to screw you that they can. My only hope actually is that the consequences are going to be so bad that they'll have to repeal it because there's just no way they'll be able to blame it on freedom or whatever like they like to. It'll be so clear that this law is what set all the incentives even more perverted than before and raised everybody's prices even more than before, and that maybe eventually there'll be a pushback, but I don't know. There's interests involved, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, hey, listen, great work all the way around. I love your blog, and thank you again for your time on the show, Marcy. Appreciate it.
Take care, Scott.
All right, babe. That is the great Empty Wheel, emptywheel.net, Marcy Wheeler, and also follow her on Twitter, too, would you? And we'll be right back with Alan Butler right after this. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. And online's our good friend Alan Butler from the Liberty Express. Hey, Alan, how are you?
I'm fine, Scott. Thanks for having me. How are things out there in lovely Austin, Texas?
Everything's great. It's a beautiful day. Appreciate you joining us today. So, you know, I saw on the TV that people were complaining that there was going to be a government shutdown. And I thought, people complain about government shutdowns? That's odd, because that's the only thing I want in the world is for the government to shut down. But I guess my priorities are a little bit different than everybody else's. What does that even mean? And in fact, what is this whole gimmick with the debt ceiling? There ain't no ceiling in the world that you just, crank it up like a car jack and just keep raising it and raising it and raising it up to the moon. It's not a ceiling at all. And all they ever do is raise it anyway. So why do they even have one unless it's so that they can, I don't know, shut the government down every once in a while? I mean, I'm for that, but...
Oh, you know, to me, it's funny when they, and you and I both know, they're going to raise the debt ceiling, and I think this will be the 101st or 102nd time since the debt ceiling was raised. They will raise it later this week, and the media will act as if we averted some sort of crisis. From my perspective, the crisis is them raising the debt ceiling, not failing to do so, because... however much they raise the debt ceiling by this time around will be how much new money Ben Bernanke prints and puts into the economy, and then that's going to cause prices to go up. Them raising the debt ceiling is a bad thing, not a good thing.
Well, and I think you were telling us before that the only people, the only net buyers of U.S. debt at this point is the Federal Reserve Bank, the Federal Reserve System, that China keeps buying debt, but yeah, they're selling it too, and they're selling more than they're buying.
Absolutely. Through August 28th of this year, the Federal Reserve has purchased right at 115% of the net new treasuries issued so far this year. The way they get into exceeding 100% is that they're buying not only all of the debt that's been issued so far this year, but debt that was issued in prior years. So, essentially, the government now has only one buyer. That buyer is the Federal Reserve, and we are generating tremendous amounts of future inflation with all of this bond buying.
Mm. Now, I once knew a paper money guy. And he wanted it to just be the Treasury, not the Federal Reserve. But basically he was saying that, look, I mean, the way it is with the way that the gimmick works, of course, with the Congress spending money they don't have and then the Federal Reserve creating money out of thin air with their magic and secrecy and whatever, police power, and then buying that new debt, that they could just keep doing that forever. And that really, when you say a dollar, what you're saying is a 1/16 trillionth. And they can keep on going. In fact, I think at the time, he probably used 16 trillionth as the ultimate example. It was back when the national debt was only 7 or 10 trillion or something like that. And he was going, no, I mean, you could even have where a dollar is just a 1/16 trillionth. And we just keep on going like this. Why not? In fact, at this point, why not have Nixon's guaranteed minimum income for everybody as long as they're counterfeiting money all day? What's the problem?
Well, I think you bring up a good point, and if the American people understood the monetary system, like Henry Ford said, we'd have a revolution by morning. But as you know, since you're well informed, what we circulate for money in the United States is the national debt. It is a note. It's a promissory note. It's an absurd system. That we, the American people, pay interest to the Federal Reserve on money that the Federal Reserve creates out of nothing.
Boy, and you know, it really hits hard when you think about a 30-year note. We're like, okay, it makes sense that you got to pay for a house to live in, whatever the market value of a house is. But first of all, we don't know what the market value of a house is, not by a long shot. But second of all, who do you have to pay? You have to pay a bank that didn't even have any money when they loaned it to you? Well, that doesn't quite seem fair. How come you can't just loan the money to yourself and pay yourself back for 30 years then, if that's how it is? As long as we're just making stuff up here. Anyway, I could see the temptation to be a paper money crank rather than a gold standard guy, but...
paper bugs, is what we call them.
But so now back to this whole shutdown thing. So this whole thing's a ruse, and they're not going to shut down a thing because the Republicans are just going to pass the thing just like always, or this time there's going to actually be a little hiccup in it. Does it matter?
No, I think they're going to pass it. And, you know, if this were the crisis they're making it out to be, would they have taken a five-week vacation. And then, you know, the Senate doesn't even convene until later on this afternoon, within hours of the government supposedly shutting down. And if they do shut it down, which they're not, it'll wind up being a paid vacation or paid holiday for federal employees. This is nothing but a smokescreen.
Yeah, well, and of course, the only thing so close, they won't close down the DEA or any, you know, band of thugs out to seize your bank account. They can still do whatever they want, but they'll shut down Yosemite National Park for you, make you hate them Republicans good.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. The GOP, I mean, they're not, we've seen what they do when they have office. They spend money the way the Democrats spend money. In fact, I would argue that both political parties are parties of inflationists. And when the Democrats claim they're out to help the poor and the disadvantaged and the senior citizens and refuse to cut spending, then that means they're for inflation. And when Republicans refuse to cut spending and refuse to raise taxes, now I don't want to see them raise taxes, I'm just saying that that is what they do, then that means they're for inflation, which means both political parties are essentially for inflating away our standard of living.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing, that other than the boom and the bust cycle and all of that, it seems to me the most insidious thing about the monetary system that we have is, you know, where people say inflation is good for the poor because they can borrow dollars and pay back in dimes and all that, but it makes sure that they stay on the debtor end of that equation. It makes sure that somebody who's a debtor never becomes a creditor of his own, because he has no ability to save, really. If you make more than you're spending to stay alive, then you got to find some way to risk that money to take care of. You can't just put it in a savings account or you'll lose out to inflation. Might as well be a crime. And so then everybody's forced into betting on the stock market or betting on the housing market or whatever else. They end up getting taken, you know, all the money gets taken out from the top, and all the losers at the top get bailed out at their expense and get double screwed on it. And meanwhile, though, if you had an actual capitalist system where loans came from actual capital that was saved up, you had whatever prevailing free market interest rates, then yeah, it would be difficult maybe to take out a loan and pay it back at a higher interest rate, but it would also mean that you have the ability to save and maybe one day be the one making the loan, you know?
The inflation tax is the cruelest tax of all because it's an indiscriminate tax. It takes most of its, in percentage terms, most of its money from the people who are most vulnerable in our society, the poor, our senior citizens, our middle class. And I believe that this constant debasement of the currency is what has, in large part, helped to erode the moral fiber of America. You know, when I grew up, you had one spouse work and the other spouse stay at home and raise a family. Well, that's not possible anymore. It's not possible because both spouses have to go out and work because the currency isn't worth as much. I have a friend of mine's son. He's 26 years old, Scott. He's making $12 an hour, and the only thing preventing him from being forced to live at what we call the Atlanta Union Mission, which is for the total indigents, is the fact that he's living with his family, and he and I sat down and did the math. When I was his age, $12 an hour, which today is $24,000 a year and some change, the purchasing power of me making $12 an hour when I was 26, in today's dollars, I would have to be paid $106,000 a year. And that's staggering to think that $12 an hour back then would compute to $106,000 a year today. That is what they have done to the currency. And when, you know, people talk about a currency collapse, hell, it's already collapsed. All we're arguing about is this last little 3%. It's a crime.
Well, you know, it's hard to break this down, and I ain't a scholar on this kind of stuff, man. I'm more interested in foreign policy kinds of things, but Sheldon Richman and the C4SS guys, they're really better on all this
kind of thing than me, but there's, you know, somewhere in there is a sophisticated libertarian class theory that it sounds in some ways like communist class theory, but not quite the same, because, of course, the division is those who use state power against their neighbors, as opposed to just rich versus poor. But the thing of it is, an honest libertarian has to recognize, of course, that it's the rich that are using the state power against the poor more than anything else, and against the middle class more than anything else. And I think that really, you know, it's like that George Carlin routine where he just repeats it over and over again. Like, he's just trying to drill it through their head. He knows that it's too difficult for them to comprehend, so he just says it over and over again. They don't care about you. There's a big club and you're not in it. Stop believing in them because they're not here for you. They really aren't, kind of a thing. And I think that, you know, we're all raised to believe in patriotism, and we just kind of assume, we kind of project the idea that, you know, a senator or someone who's rich and powerful enough to pick a senator that, or have, you know, major influence in who the next senator is going to be or whatever, that those kind of people at some level, they care about the country. They do care that, you know, people on at least the right side of town have the ability to get a job, if not the people on the wrong side of town. And it's, I'm reminded from time to time, it does sort of sound like communist class theory and whatever. But again, I think it's partially accurate. But it's like this one commenter is always saying on my blog, on the archives of this show, is this is all a war of the rich versus the poor. And they do not care about us. And that goes for the state and its enforcers. But it also goes, you know, it's just like this is fascism in Italy, too. It's not just that the state is bossing around all the private property owners. The private property owners made it that way. They like it that way. They want their will to all be law, for all their prices to be fixed. You know, it's them conspired together against the rest of us. And I guess I think people just can't comprehend it because of the red, white, and blue flag floating in their face all day and all the hoorah and whatever that obscures who's zooming who here. Who has influence over the Fed? Who is it that wants inflation? The poor or the very rich, you know? I'm sorry for going on so long, but it seems like it's pretty brutal what's happening to people right now. Like, you could tell them about, say whatever you want about that whole rant, but then also work in about the real unemployment rates right now, and especially among the poor and among, you know, racial minorities and that kind of thing. It's horrible.
Yeah, right now the media has done a great job of painting a portion of the unemployment as the representative of the actual number of unemployed. As you know, every month I am privileged to have the former head, the former commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics on my show, and as a result of over 100 hours of interviews, I've gotten quite the education on the unemployment slash employment rate. The go-to rate for the Bureau of Labor Statistics for the career statisticians is what they call the employment ratio, the employment-to-population ratio, which measures the percentage of the workforce currently employed, and that number is at a four-year low. We hit bottom back in May. That's not at a four-year low. We made a four-year low. It is at a 38-year low of 58.6%. Among men, among males, we have the lowest employment of among men than we have seen since the early 1940s. It's staggering, and yet we're being told that things are getting better. Things aren't getting better. They're getting worse.
And I guess tell us more about the unemployment, the discrepancy between what they tell you and how you read it, because it's kind of a complicated mess, but it's very interesting.
Okay. The media represents as being the unemployment rate is actually the U3. The U3 measures only people who have been unemployed for 6 months or less and who have actively looked for a job in the last 4 weeks. So if you have been unemployed for 6 months and a day, or you have not gone out and looked for a job, been on a job interview in 4 weeks, then you're not included in the U3. However, you are still unemployed. In fact, you're still getting unemployment checks. To elaborate on that further, the average unemployed person in America today has been unemployed for 44 weeks, which means the average person who is unemployed in this country isn't even included in the U3. So the reason the U3 has improved lower, the reason that number has gone down, is actually a bad sign when the total number of people working has gone down. It's because they have been unemployed so long that they roll out of the U3 and they're not counted as being unemployed.
It's like lopping zeros off the end of your dollars, right?
Absolutely, although that's maybe where we're heading.
So how long do unemployment benefits last? Because they don't just keep on paying forever, right?
Well, you remember we've had under these various stimulus programs and continuing resolutions, they got out to 52 weeks. Now they're at 99 weeks.
At 99 weeks. And then what happens? You just move down into the Salvation Army?
Yeah, or go to the Atlanta Union Mission like I was talking about. But right now we have, what Keith told me is a good way to look at the what you and I would think of as unemployment. He is pegging at around 24.4% of the total population. Currently is out of work, wanting to work. 1 in 4. And this is worse than it was when the recovery supposedly started in June of 2009. And anecdotally, we're beginning to see more and more evidence that the economy has turned down yet again. And it's turning down in an environment where unemployment is already high and interest rates are already at zero. Clearly, the medicine isn't working. They need to change what they're doing.
Right. Well, sort of back to the patriotism thing, the difference between the country and the economy versus how those who are the vested interests involved are doing. And they're all still doing great, right? The arms dealers, the pill pushers, the bankers, the farmers, the farm corporations, the insurance companies, they're all still making money hand over fist, the leading hedge firms and all of that. It's everybody else that's screwed.
Well, and I don't think it's any coincidence that the wealthiest part of the country now is in that Washington D.C. area, the best housing market in terms of house prices is in that Washington D.C. area, and obviously number two is up there on Wall Street. So you know what we're seeing is that revolving door between Washington and Wall Street. This has all been engineered to benefit the political and financial elites at everyone else's expense. This has been probably the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of the human race.
Man. Well, and then so, but it's like the mob. They take over your business. They liquidate all your stock, take whatever money, then burn it down for the insurance and go. But where are these people planning on going if they're not going to leave in America left when they're done burning it down and taking everything that we got? And Luna, it's like that old Onion article. I had a shirt like this. 1% finished construction of their own private escape pod. You know, but where are they off to? Mars? What are they going to do after they're done destroying America forever?
They'll move on to the next one.
Go to China?
I don't know.
Have to learn Chinese?
Well, Mandarin, we probably should learn Mandarin. But not for that reason. Of course, China's got problems of their own. I did hear one description I thought that was good, though. China, the Chinese have given communism a good name. We have given capitalism a bad name.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. But yeah, boy, you talk about housing bubbles. They got whole cities that nobody wanted over there. You want to talk about malinvestment? You should send the Austrian school on a field trip to China right now and go and check out some of that stuff, man.
Well, you know, I think that points to the worthlessness of GDP as some meaningful economic measure. that counts towards their GDP, just like here in this country when they were doing $250,000 studies of male prostitutes in Vietnam and shrimps on a treadmill and things like that. I mean, GDP counts all of that wasteful government spending as if it were, you know, real economic activity.
Man, and so all those Navy ships, just think of the aircraft carriers. You know, in George Orwell, at the part where O'Brien the torturer is pretending to be Winston's friend, and he gives him the manifesto about how we screw everybody, and it says in there that the only reason we're at war all the time is so that we could keep everybody on edge all the time, and we could take, it's our excuse to take all the excess productivity from the people and either blast it off into space, or in the case of the floating fortress, sink it into the ocean where they can't get their hands on it, where they might be able to better spend it improving their own lives, improving their own minds, and asserting their own power. That's what it's all about, is just finding something to spend the money. And then call it GDP, too. Look, everybody, we created a giant floating fortress. Aren't you impressed?
Scott, do you think any of your listeners actually believe that they're not going to raise the debt ceiling?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think whatever possibility anybody entertains, we all understand that it would only be as a political stunt kind of a thing so that the Republicans could make one sector of their constituency believe in them for a minute or something like that, if it was to happen at all. I mean, I don't think any listeners to my show are caught up in the they may be left and right to a degree, but they're not Republicans and Democrats so much, I don't figure.
Well, you know, it looks
not,
to me
not
like...
Not for too long, anyway. Not after hanging around here.
Since you mentioned the Republicans, I mean, they're negotiating against themselves right now. If all spending originates in the House and the Republicans control the House, then the Republicans, it's not up to them to come up with something that Harry Reid agrees with, since it is the House that is responsible for the spending. It's up to Harry Reid to accept something coming out of the House.
Mm-hmm.
So it's as if, you know, okay, you don't like this one, we'll offer this and this. I mean, the fact that they are engaged in that kind of tactic tells me that they really, genuinely do not want to cut spending. But I think you and I both know that.
Nah, of course not. Well, and why would they when they can just keep printing it? And apparently... The Federal Reserve, I think because Ron Paul probably scared the hell out of them a little bit. I think out of Ben Bernanke. I think that they had to figure out this great scam where they can inflate all this money supply but keep it on the shelf. Make all of the most powerful people whole on Wall Street and never give it to Main Street. But then, you know, in parentheses, thank God, right? Because if they started loaning it all out, especially with the multiplier effect of the fractional reserve ratio and everything, then we would really be lopping zeros off of dollars and have a real, you know, dollar crisis. Right now, we can't afford growth. Groceries, right? But the grocery store is open, which is a different situation than a real hyperinflation, right?
Well, it's a tragic situation, and they will raise the debt ceiling. The media will act as if they have averted a crisis, and when in reality, they are creating the next one.
Well, and then, so when Ben Bernanke announced that he was going to not taper, that he's just going to continue buying the debt, that's an indication, right, that he knows that if he stops inflating, then the whole jobless recovery, such as it is, comes crashing down, right? He's inflating to prevent the recession that we had come and do. And, I guess at some point, if the inflation got too far out of control, then he would have to force that recession anyway. And we'd end up going through the same pain only, you know, 6-7 years later or whatever. Am I right?
I would agree with that. But I think that using the economy, that Ben Bernanke is using the weak economy as a cover to continue to prop up the banks. Because how could... even a Princeton-educated economist, a Keynesian, actually think that creating money to buy mortgage-backed securities and treasuries off of bankers and then paying them interest not to lend the money to the rest of us, how does that help the economy. And I would argue it doesn't help the economy. It's not designed to help the economy. It's designed to monetize the government's debt and to enrich and bail out the banks.
All right, and now that's a new law, right, that enables them to do that, or a new rule or regulation that enables them to do that. But so if it was, if all that money was just going to the banks, it would still have to be in their interest to loan that money out. And right now you still have so many bad debts still being liquidated, and so much downward pressure on wages and prices, as somebody or other saying in the chat room there, I can't pronounce that, then that wouldn't necessarily lead to a bunch of new loans, right? All that money could well just be sitting down at the local thrift in their vault and still not being loaned out, because who to loan it to? In this climate.
But they're being paid interest not to lend the money out. That's the thing. Ben Bernanke is creating this money out of thin air, buying these mortgage-backed securities from whom? From the banks, and then paying them interest on that newly created money that the banks receive for selling Ben Bernanke mortgage-backed securities.
Yeah, worthless paper.
Well, but he's paying them interest so they won't lend it out. So, I mean, there's no way one could argue that that somehow or another is benefiting the general economy. I don't believe it's intended to. I believe it's like I said, it's designed to monetize the debt in the case of the treasuries and to continue to bail out the banks in the case of the mortgage-backed securities.
Right.
Because it doesn't make sense.
Well, my fear is that if he wasn't paying them interest to keep it at the Fed, and it was in their interest to loan it all out, that it would help too much, and it would end up leading to real price problems across the board, you know?
Well, it would lead to hyperinflation.
That's what I'm saying. That would be my worry. So, really, we're screwed either way, coming or going. That's the bottom line. And now we gotta go. Thanks very much for coming on the show, Alan. I sure appreciate it.
Hey, I always enjoy talking to you.
All right, everybody, that's our friend Alan Butler from the Liberty Express, libertyexpressradio.com, host of Butler on Business. And we'll be right back with MJ Rosenberg right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, all Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. I'm going to go ahead and lie, but it's only about by 3 or 4 now, maybe 3. We got 3,000 interviews at scotthorton.org. It's actually 2,997 or something like that after this one. But anyway, I'm going to round up because, you know, once you get to 5, then you can round up. I learned that in the first grade there, government school. 3,000 interviews at scotthorton.org. And also, you can join up the chat room there, hang out during the show, and check out the stress blog. I'm trying to start writing things on it again a little bit. And, of course, you can also follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. So, scotthorton.org and /ScottHortonShow. That's what you need to know there. Okay, so next up is our friend MJ Rosenberg. He writes at mjrosenberg.com, and you got to spell out J like Homer J. Simpson, MJ Rosenberg. .com. And actually, my man, do you actually own the URL M letter J Rosenberg 2 and have it forwarding on? I should test that.
No, no. Somebody else has that. Doesn't
oh, no. It. Someone else has that? That's
yeah,
terrible.
Someone just has it and never has used it.
Oh, man.
So,
well, that's
yeah,
too
so
bad.
I'm stuck with that J A Y, but what can you do?
Yeah, no, it's all right. you know, some other guy's got ScottHorton.com. He's a newspaper man in Oklahoma. Nice guy. But he's owned ScottHorton.com since 1994 or something. He's never given it up.
Can't complain about that too much.
Yeah. I should just thank my lucky stars I got .org. Okay.
Yeah, right.
All right, so listen, you write great things. The one I'm looking at is called The Lobby Sets Out to Defeat Obama on Iran. And I was thinking, you know, really, a good way to set this up would be to allow you to give a little bit of friendly advice to AIPAC about whether they're really blowing it here and jumping their shark and overdoing it and flying too close to the sun and making a terrible mistake that might cost them their future power and influence on other issues.
Well, that is so I should give friendly advice. That is almost impossible for me to give because I'm an unfriendly, but I can tell you what I originally thought they would do. I thought the obvious thing they would do after that phone call between President Obama and President Rouhani was that they would simply claim victory, that both Netanyahu and the lobby would just say, well, the sanctions that we wrote, I remember AIPAC wrote them. I mean, Congress passed them, but AIPAC wrote them. The sanctions that we wrote did the job. The Iranians are surrendering. They're basically going to agree to our terms. This isn't necessarily true, but they're going to agree to our terms on the nuke stuff. And therefore, this is a great day for everybody. Great day for Iran, but most of all, great day for Israel. Great day for the United States. This is great. And because that's what you do if you're an if you're a smart organization or a smart government or anything. You're much better off claiming victory, especially when a few weeks ago AIPAC was widely and correctly seen as being defeated in their efforts to get that bombing of Syria. So really, I was sure they were going to do that. I said that to my wife, and I said, "Oh, they're definitely going to just. I mean, they'll finesse this. They can figure this out." And she said, "Are you crazy? Netanyahu won't let them do that. It's Netanyahu really is incapable of doing that for a number of reasons, including the fact that, one, he is insanely devoted to the idea of defeating Iran militarily, and also because he's got all these right-wingers who would never, you know, further right-wingers who would never let him do it." Mm-hmm. So instead of them doing the thing that would save AIPAC and preserve its role as the most dominant lobby in America, they are instead going to fight Obama. And I think it will start with the Netanyahu UN speech. Sometimes I say Israel. Sometimes I say Netanyahu. Sometimes I say AIPAC. But it doesn't matter. It's all the same.
It all just means those who run the Israeli state.
Yeah, exactly. And try to run this one.
Yeah. Well, why throw in try? I mean, come on.
Yeah, why try? Right.
All right. Well, now, so they're going to be fighting alone on this, right? Or with Lindsey Graham. But is anyone, I mean, it seems like, well, maybe I'm just wishful thinking. I'm having such a good time with the Iranians and Americans talking at the level they're talking at this point. I'm a little bit giddy, but I sort of think that maybe this means that some significant parts of the American establishment, if not at AIPAC, have decided that let's go ahead and put this thing to bed. We can deal with these guys. And it's so obvious that Rouhani really means it, at least for now, and he has the backing of the Supreme Leader, at least for now, to really make a deal.
Am I right about that?
Is it AIPAC versus everybody on this?
Yeah, it is. Well, there are also the regular old hawk right wingers who like war in general. I mean, the people who in general like to resolve all international problems by killing people, it's not limited to the Israel lobby. There are lots of just, you know, free floating right wingers. If you can read them in the media, I can usually tell by reading them whether their main concern is Israel or just the fact that they like to kill, you know, innocent people on the ground. But it's more than that. I mean, there are, like, for instance, the Republican right, The Democrats who are hawkish on these issues are entirely driven by AIPAC. Because it goes against, in general, it goes against the general worldview that they apply to everything else, which is it's better to negotiate at least first before you start going to war. But the Republicans, they don't need AIPAC to tell them that they want to kill Muslims. They're driven by all kinds of other things, including the Christian need that, you know, they're Christian, appeasing their Christians, or not just appeasing them, actually they are. I mean, they're into civilizational war with the Muslims. But in general, the fact is the one poll I've seen so far shows that 75% of the American public welcome this talking to Iran. So if that's true, and the same kind of 75% was opposed to bombing Syria, it really does indicate that there might be some kind of a shift within the thinking of the American people that makes it impossible for AIPAC to put over another war the way they have in the past. And, I mentioned, I think, to you last time that, Congressman Grayson, Alan Grayson, who was the leading opponent of bombing Syria and is totally an AIPAC guy, was asked, well, is AIPAC losing this? And he said, well, AIPAC can't win when the American people speak in one voice. And that's so I'm – so you know what? I'm as giddy as you are. I really am. I'm just trying not to be because it's unprofessional.
Yeah, exactly. We've got some cynicism to maintain here. And you know what? I have no belief in Barack Obama at all. It's simply a matter of mathematics on a page, just like Ludwig von Mises says. It's simply a calculation for him – in terms of measuring the power of the Democratic Party and its allies in Washington, D.C., you know, that's all he cares about. And so it does have to be just like that, you know, the American people versus AIPAC, and the line's that clear where even Grayson has to do the right thing would be how I would put it. But, you know.
But the only thing is, the thing you have to worry about, though, is it only happened on Friday. What happens if I don't know who's the head of the Democrat. The head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has the wonderful name of Steve Israel, which I think is the best name ever for someone whose sole job is raising money for the Democratic, Democratic Party House elections.
You're such an anti-Semite, dude.
Right. I'm an observant Jew, not even the washed-out assimilationist kind. But anyway, when Steve Israel comes to Obama and he comes in maybe with the head of AIPAC and they say, this is going to cost you this much money, I don't know. I mean, as I've mentioned to you in the past, the Democratic Party is so heavily reliant on the AIPAC crowd for campaign contributions. Mm-hmm. So right now, I think, okay, so I go along with you on this. Obama makes, this is an unsentimental calculation he's made. But if that's all it is, it can then go the other way. I don't think that's all it is. I think this is what Obama wants to do. I think that the last thing he wants to do is have the war with Iran that George W. Bush rejected.
Leaving it at the status quo where George Bush left it is a pretty bad legacy, if you ask me. And of course,
it makes
perfect sense to make the deal. I mean, it's ridiculous to still have this kind of official enmity with Iran after all this time.
There is a real politic reason for it, from a hawkish point of view, which is that it looks like the most anti-American forces in the Middle East right now are the extreme Sunni Muslims, the Al Qaeda people and their followers in Syria, the people that the Saudis back, all those people, the people who pulled off that awful massacre in Nairobi. Those, I mean, if you know, the hawks like to always talk about the something, what do they call the Shiite arc or Shiite, like this thing in the region that just threatened all American interests, which ran from Iran, Iran through, Syria, Hezbollah, that kind of thing. Right now, the threat really looks like the people backed by the Saudis and the people that the Israelis don't even care about, which is these various al-Qaeda-linked crazy people who like blowing up things for its own sake rather than having any kind of particular interest in, like, fighting for their country or anything like that. That is, those people are more scary right now. And if the United States settles its differences with Iran, Iran can help us deal with them. They've done that in the past. They don't like the Taliban any more than we do. And they helped us with the Taliban in the past. So it could be a real, actually in cold terms, it could also be a good idea. You know, cold strategic terms, even though I don't really know how to think that way, but,
Well, I was thinking I could probably make a fortune doing public relations for Israel right now because they're just blowing it, man. They keep blurting out things like Ehud Barak saying, "The world must rally behind General Sisi and the new coup d'etat dictatorship in Egypt." Like, hey, man, shut up. I don't even like Ehud Barak or agree with his prop-up dictatorship position at all, but just from an objective point of view, hush.
They seem incapable of not saying everything they think. You had people in the, ministers, one minister in the Israeli government said, "Well, actually, we're not for any particular side in Syria. We just want them all to kill each other off."
Right.
Well, we know that's what their position is.
Well, and then Michael Oren,
who says things like that?
Well, Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador to America, said that. Basically, I'm paraphrasing him. Yeah, we prefer al-Qaeda to Hezbollah in Syria. That's what this is, ultimately.
Right.
And because Hezbollah and Syria's government are backed by Iran, that means we prefer whoever the jihadists are, fighting them on the other side, which also means that's why America supports them, too. Our only real enemies, the guys that attack the towers, we support them because they're opposing Israel's enemies in Hezbollah right now. And why do they even have access? Anyway, because the neocons and Ariel Sharon's office pushed us into war with Iraq 10 years ago and turned that entire civilization upside down and spread their Sunni-based insurgency back to Syria. It had come in part from Syria to help them fight, and now it's gone home to roost.
Exactly right. The Israelis don't care about al-Qaeda at all. I mean, look, Benjamin Netanyahu wasn't prime minister then. He was the leader of the opposition. But what he said on 9/11 2001 was, "This is a great thing." He said it's a great day because now America and Israel, have the same enemies. Well, from his point of view, it might have looked like that for a day. But the fact is, we're seeing now, and we've been seeing over the past few years, they don't give a damn about nihilists from al-Qaeda. They don't care. And also, every time anybody attacks the United States, they think it's good because it will eventually lead us to opposing all Muslims or something. But we're really not on the same side of this stuff. Iran and Hezbollah are not a threat to the United States. The threat are the people who blew up the World Trade Center. Can it be any more obvious? There was a gigantic hole in the ground for 10 years.
Right.
I mean, but that's not the way they see it. And, that's why, Joe Biden has his favorite line about there must be no daylight. I always like to quote him. He says it twice. He says there must be no daylight between Israeli and U.S. policies. Well, nice try, but it's a gigantic sun rising of daylight right now that shows that Israel's interests and Israel's security concerns are not the same as ours. Also, if the government of Israel really cared about its own people, it would realize that having al-Qaeda on its northern border, rather than Hafez Assad, who, for all his crimes, kept the peace with Israel for 20 years or 30 years, why are they on the other side of this? They don't even care about their own people, and I believe they don't. Because I actually, if you look at it logically, and in terms of real, live people, people with children, people like that, peace between the United States and Iran a situation where the United States can talk to Iran and has good relations with Iran are infinitely better for Israel than what they're proposing, which is what? That we ultimately have a war that erupts that entire region and can consume Israel completely? They're nuts.
Right. Yeah, it makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, the people of Israel, you know, I know they're pretty much as helpless to control their government as we are to control ours. But, man, they ought to be doing everything they can to just shut Netanyahu up. His speech to the UN ought to be, thank you, America, for seeing what's good for me, better than me. Because otherwise, like you're saying, and this could be the last chance that we have for a long time to normalize these relations. And think of it from the American national interest point of view. If Obama, and it's just too obvious, so I'm sorry to be a broken record on it, audience, but the Nixon goes to China thing. Nixon made it okay that he lost the Vietnam War because he undid domino number one in the domino theory, that if they all go communist, they'll all be under the sway of Red China. Well, he made friends with Red China, so it doesn't matter. And then, so he went ahead and lost Vietnam because he couldn't win anyway, so went ahead and lost it, but it was okay because he had made friends with Red China. Well, in this case, we can go ahead and make friends with Green Iran, and then we don't have to back Al-Qaeda against Hezbollah in Syria anymore, you know? It'll be great.
Exactly. It just makes sense. That I think the thing we have to really worry about is, well, first of all, you know, that even though we both say that it's common sense for Netanyahu to get up there and say, thank you, President Obama, this is a good opening for all of us, we know that we're going to enjoy it a lot more when he goes up and he has cartoons and pictures and talks about the Germans in 1942 and all this crazy stuff, because it's fun watching him in extremists, you know, just watching Netanyahu going down. And I'm sure that's what the speech he's going to give. It's going to be a wacko hate speech, because that is pretty much the only kind he's capable of. I think the thing we really have to worry about is if the people who really, you know, who run Iran, the ones who have allowed the president to go ahead with this and who are backing him, his opening to the United States, we don't know how much time they're giving him. I mean, you know, if Iran keeps reaching out and the Israelis keep doing their stuff and President Obama, let's say, back, you know, just pulls back a little because he has to conciliate AIPAC or whatever, they can decide to just pull Rouhani back. This an opening like this doesn't last forever. I mean, that China-U.S. moment in 1972 might not have lasted forever. It was seized.
Right.
So I think the APAC Netanyahu game right now could be to slow things down. I don't think Netanyahu that Obama's going to go along with it. I think Obama also wants a fast deal. I mean,
well, he better. I mean, why even make the phone call? Why even go along with this at all if he doesn't really mean it at this point?
The phone call was really the sign, because we all knew this was going on in the back, you know, that this stuff was going on. But it was almost like, hey, and before you go out of town, I've got to give you something concrete. I'm going to pick up the phone. I mean, wouldn't you have loved to be in APAC headquarters when that happened? Oh, my God. I would say that was the worst moment they have ever lived through. Their president, their Democratic president, oh, my God. But, you know, never underestimate the mischief that they can do. But nonetheless, I'm really optimistic. If someone asked me, I said, if I had to put money on it right now, I say we're going to get a deal with them. There's going to be a U.S.-Iranian deal, and the world is going to be a much better place. It's still going to suck, but it's going to be a much better place.
Well, the possibilities right now are certainly better than they have been in a long time. And, of course, if they really wanted to exploit this thing, they could use the obvious nuclear deal that's already been laying on the table for a few years now. They could use that as just a method to really open the door to normalize relations completely and do the go-to-China moment, really make friends with them. And you know, who needs enemies except arms dealers, you know?
Except what? Oh, arms dealers. Yeah, right, right. No, I think that, you know, I think that old deal that, I don't know, we basically walked away. Yeah, we walked away from. It's still good.
Yeah.
I think in this kind of situation, all you need is both sides having the will to make a deal. And we can see on the Iranian side they've got it, and it looks like Obama has it too. And I don't see, you know, there are no reports at all. I think it's like, it's significant that there's an undercurrent in the administration itself of people against this. You know, it would be kind of troubling if there, you know, if there was, let's say, if you were reading the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense, this might be why it's significant that Chuck Hagel is there at the Defense Department. Because despite all the lies he had to tell about his positions on Israel, when in fact we all know what he really thinks about things, he's somebody who, I'm sure he's backing Obama. Kerry obviously is. He doesn't have to worry right now about Hillary Clinton rushing off to fundraisers and saying, oh, I'll help slow this down. So, you know, it could be a very propitious moment. We always said it would happen in a president's second term. So, I mean, like, you know, why not do it? So, but, you know, one thing that might it a little bit tricky in terms of knowing what the Republicans think, well, they're so busy right now trying to, shut down the government and then hopefully destroy America's economic standing in the world and make everybody more poor than they were before, that they really can't focus on silly things like this. They really have a job to do right now, and you know, their job is, in my opinion, sedition and treason. And I don't even see any of these guys like Eric Cantor saying anything. I think they're distracted. It's like, where can I do the most evil? And they're thinking right now they could do more evil domestically.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, geez, you'd think that Eric Cantor could multitask of all people, but. So what do you think about the so-called peace process in the West Bank and all of that two-state, one-state bogusness?
What did you say? I'm sorry, I missed it.
I just wonder what you think about it all. I tried to make the question overly broad. Kerry and Martin Indyk over there going to bring peace?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I don't see this. Look, the day that I see concrete evidence that Benjamin Netanyahu is willing to give up one square mile of land in the West Bank, I'll believe it. I mean, they won't even. No, you talked about the Nixon goes to China thing, and sometimes people say that about Netanyahu. Well, the difference is that slug Nixon really wanted to go to China. That slug Netanyahu really wants to keep every inch of the West Bank.
Yeah.
It's entirely different.
Right. By the way, you know what? That's two Nixon references. I got to mention, it's in the New York Times today about him and Kissinger conspiring with the government of Pakistan to massacre a million people in Bangladesh, which was East Pakistan at the time today. And Kissinger and Nixon both mocking the deaths of a million civilians.
I'm halfway through that book. It's called Blood Telegram.
Oh, yeah?
It is the most amazing book. You know, I'm older than you, so obviously I was around and I remember that, you know, I remember the tilt to Pakistan. I had no idea that it was this bad. If you really want to see how America operates, this book is it. Yeah, and the good side of it, the flip of it is there were amazing people at the State Department, including this guy named Blood. It's called Blood Telegram, but his name was Blood, who was the consul general in East Pakistan, who publicly fought the administration on this. And the U.S. ambassador to India, whose name was Kenneth Keating, who wrote, they sent cables back home to Kissinger and Nixon, said, this is genocide. And Kissinger, that old bastard, I'm sorry, am I not allowed to say that?
Go right ahead, man.
Okay.
That's his middle name, it's okay.
Well, here he is. I'm so glad that he is alive and got a chance, as you know he did, to read that New York Times book review of this book yesterday. This is, I mean, it's somehow, you know, the Chile anniversary wasn't, there wasn't enough pointing to the fact that he and Nixon were the guys who overthrew the Allende government. This story is. But this is, we're talking mass murder here. I mean, there were lots of murders in Chile, too. Nothing like this. We're talking genocide that was supported by Nixon and Kissinger. Everybody should read this book.
And I'm trying to remember on, there's a master list of American post-World War II interventions by William Blum or Blum at Third World Traveler. And I'm trying to remember if this one is on that list. It's such a long list of innocents murdered. It's incredible. Someone else was bringing up on my Facebook page about Kissinger again here, I believe, Sukarno and killing a million people in the... one-sided civil war, if you want to call it that at all, you know, back in the 50s in Indonesia.
Hey, see, that Henry Kissinger is really something. He really belongs there on the Hitler-Stalin list. You know, I think once you get responsible for more than a million dead, you're kind of, it's not that big a list. I mean, it's a big enough list, but Kissinger really is a mass murderer. And I really want him to live to be 100 because I'm hoping that in time he will just be recognized as the absolute monster of America, almost the a monster without parallel in American history. And there have been a lot of them.
Yeah, no,
but,
it's definitely
just amazing.
Well, what's funny is he's writing op-eds saying, "Hey, stay out of Syria. This could be a mess." He's a reasonable one now.
I know. You can't keep up with people like that.
All right. Hey, thanks, MJ. It's great to talk to you again.
Okay, Scott. Take care.
Hey, everybody. Read MJ Rosenberg at mjrosenberg.com. And thanks for listening to the show. See you tomorrow.